ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। नारायणं नमस्कृत्यं नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जयमुदीरयेत्। नष्टप्रायेषु अभद्रेषु नित्यं भागवत सेवया भगवती उत्तमश्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्ठिकी। कृष्णाय वासुदेवाय देवकी नंदनाय च नंदगोपकुमाराय गोविंदाय नमो नमः। ओम अज्ञानतिमिरंधस्य ज्ञानांजनशलाकया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपकदा मह्यं ददाति स्वपदांतिकं। वंदेहं श्रीगुरो श्रीयुता पदकमलं श्रीगुरुन् वैष्णवांश्च श्रीरूपं साग्रजातं सहगन रघुनाथान्वितं त्वं सजीवं साद्वैतं सावधूतं परिजना सहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधा कृष्णपादान् सहगणललिता श्रीविशाखान्वितांश्च। नमा ओं विष्णुपादाय कृष्णपृष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्तिवेदांत स्वामीनिति नामिने। नमस्ते सरस्वती देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेष शून्यवादी पाश्चात्य देशतारिणे। नमो महावदन्याय कृष्ण प्रेम प्रदायते कृष्णाय कृष्ण चैतन्या नामने गौरद्विषे नमः। हे कृष्णा करुणा सिंधो दीनबंधो जगत्पते गोपेश गोपिका कांत राधा कांत नमोस्तुते। तप्त कांचन गौरांगी राधे वृंदावनेश्वरी वृषभानुसुते देवी मामी हरि प्रिये। वांछाकल्पतरुर्भ्यश्च कृपा सिंधुभ्यैव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधार श्रीवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद। हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे। सर्वशास्त्राब्धि पीयूषा सर्ववेदैक सत्फला सर्वसिद्धांत रत्नाढ्या सर्वलोकैक दृक्प्रदा सर्वभागवत प्राण श्रीमद् भागवतम् प्रभो कलिध्वांतोदितादित्य श्रीकृष्ण परिवर्तिता। Reading from Canto 11, Chapter 9, Text 14. Ekachari aniketasyad apramatto guhashayah alakshyamana acharair munireko alpabhashanah ekachari aniketasyad अप्रमत्तो गुहाशयः अलक्ष्यमान आचारैर् मुनिरेको अल्पभाषणः एकचारी अनिकेतः स्याद् अप्रमत्तो गुहाशयः अलक्ष्यमान आचारैर् मुनिरेको अल्पभाषणः।
एकचारी अनिकेतस्य
ततो गुहाशयः शमान आचार्य कोल्पभाषणः। माताजी आचार्य निकेतस्य प्रमत्तो गुहाशयः अलक्ष्यमान आचारैर् मुनिरेको अल्पभाषणः।
What to word meaning? Eka, alone. Chari, moving. Aniketah, without fixed residence. Syat, should be. Apramattah, being very alert. Guhashayah, remaining secluded. Alakshamanah, without being recognized. Acharaih, by his activities. Munihi, a sage. Ekah, without companions. Alpa, very little. Bhashanah, speaking. Translation and purport by the disciples of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. A saintly person should remain alone and constantly travel without any fixed residence. Being alert, he should remain secluded and should act in such a way that he is not recognized or noticed by others. Moving without companions, he should not speak more than required. The previous narration concerning the shell bracelets of the young girl demonstrates that even saintly persons engaged in ordinary yoga process should remain alone to avoid conflict or disturbance. In other words, persons engaged in ordinary yoga processes should not even associate with each other. This verse indirectly refers to the serpent who, fearing attack from human beings, keeps himself secluded. From this example, we learn that a saintly person should not associate with ordinary materialistic people. He should also avoid having a fixed residence and should wander unnoticed by others. Our engagement in material existence is the cause of our unhappiness. Such engagement destroys the real purpose of our life, Krishna consciousness. Somehow or other, one must give up the deep-rooted attachment to material society, friendship and love. One must practice detachment, and by surrender to the principles of Krishna consciousness, one's auspicious life will begin. By organizing one's life according to the Varnashram system, one can take this first step in self-realization. In other words, one should accept an honest occupation and regulate his sex life, either by giving it up entirely as a brahmachari or sannyasi, or by living as a married householder. Without regulating one's occupation and personal life, there will be chaos, and it will be very difficult to make spiritual advancement. The attachments to material society, friendship and love are based on a long previous experience in the material world. They are great obstacles in the path of transcendental understanding, and if one maintains them, spiritual progress will be most difficult. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught by his example and precept what a devotee should and should not do. And obedience to such principles brings one to the path of supreme perfection. Thus, one has to rise above ordinary social custom, which directs the living entity towards useless sense gratification. I'll read the translation once again. A saintly person should remain alone and constantly travel without any fixed residence. Being alert, he should remain secluded and should act in such a way that he is not recognized or noticed by others. Moving without companions, he should not speak more than required. So, I seek blessings of the senior devotees, Vaishnavas present here, His Grace Pankajangri Prabhu, Her Grace Varanasi Mataji. I seek their blessings that I can, and all the other assembled Vaishnavas, that I can speak something relevant for this verse. So this is the instructions of the Brahman about the 24 Gurus is still continuing. And here in this verse he's explaining what he learned from the snake. In the previous verse he had given the example of a young girl. Through her he understood how one should give up even the association of other yogis. And with the example of the snake, he is giving us the understanding that one should give up the association of materialistic people. So just like a serpent is afraid of being attacked by human beings and therefore he hides himself, similarly a transcendentalist keeps himself aloof from materialistic association. And in the purport, they mention step by step why one should not associate with materialistic people or tendencies is because the cause of our unhappiness is the engagement in this material world. Such engagement destroys our real purpose of being Krishna conscious. Therefore, one must give up material attachment to material friendship, society and love. And develop detachment and practice bhakti. Thus, one rises above ordinary social customs, which directs the living entity to useless sense gratification. So this is the verse in general. And I was going through all these qualities: ekachari, moving alone, aniketa, without fixed residence, alakshyamana, without being recognized. So it's kind of very difficult these days to practice many of those attributes. And I was trying to see, is there anything in this whole verse that we have ever practiced? So then, good fortune, we had this, in our BT training, we had this Padayatra. Supposed to be Madhukari, but it was Madhu at every step, you know, it's like. But I remember we had gone to Bhilwara and then there we had a very grand reception, and then after that we were supposed to go from village to village, not knowing where we are going, without fixed residence. So sometimes we will sleep in the schools outside the village. And suddenly one brahmachari feels something very soft in the middle of the night, close to his legs, and he gets up and there is a dog sleeping next to him. Aniketa, without fixed residence, just moving from one place to another place. Apart from that, I think Ekaha, without companions, we were actually a bunch of 20-30 young men, so it was quite exciting. But just imagine doing it all alone. Very difficult. So what I am making an attempt to do here is to understand, when we read these kind of descriptions of these very refined qualities being being the hallmark of transcendentalist and people in the renounced order, how do we understand these descriptions in the modern context? So to appreciate that better, you know, if there is a background of how the renounced order of life has evolved over the past 2000 years or more, then it gives us an understanding of how this thing can be applied. So this evolution of renounced order can be divided into three parts: the classical sannyas, there is a medieval sannyas, and there is modern context of the renounced order. So in the classical sannyas order, the main feature of the people in that order was they would live aloof from society. They'll just cut all kind of connections from society and then go to the forest. This was civilly dead, basically socially dead. And they had five prominent characteristics. People in classical sannyas had these five prominent characteristics. First was, they would cut all social ties. Second was, they would travel like a mendicant and beg their food. There is no question of cooking or anything like that. Abandon all kind of ritualistic activities, right? Celibacy and no fixed home. So they have to just keep moving. So such examples are like Narad Muni, Durvasa Muni. These are the Puranic examples, the Upanishadic examples of sannyasis or Avanti Brahman. They were the one who were actually following this particular system. In the medieval level of sannyas, the historical development during medieval times is the emergence of different schools of Vedantic thought, which became organized into monastic establishments. So that happened around 8 AD, or 8 CE as the modern parlance and common era. And they were primarily in two categories, Advaitas and Vaishnavas. So Advaita, we know the chief pontiff was Shripa Shankaracharya, who came almost 1200 years back. And Shankaracharya was responsible for developing this Dashnami Sannyas order. These 10 names of sannyasis, which is Aranya, Ashrama, Bharati, Giri, Parvat, Puri, Saraswati, Sagar, Tirth, and Vana. These were the titles of sannyas. Depending on, based on their qualities, certain kind of titles were given to people who were accepting sannyas. And Vaishnavas also developed their system of sannyas. And generally it is felt that Shankaracharya was the one who revived the system of the three dandas, the system of renunciation or the renounced order. But Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that there was a historical precedence of sannyas even before Shankaracharya, which was Devatanu Vishnu Swami, which is approximately 500 years before Shankara. Actually even before that, not 500, 1000 years before Shankara. This is 250 BC. And he had 108 names for sannyasis. Not just 8, he had 108 names for sannyasis, and that's how the renounced order of life was going on. However, after Shankaracharya, other Vaishnava schools also developed their own system of sannyas and practices, and scholars say that this was also plausibly because they wanted to confront the philosophy. And therefore, if you have to confront the philosophy, you have to be in the similar kind of socialist stature as the opponent. So then, you can actually have a conversation. So Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, all these personalities also evolved their own sannyas orders. However, the difference from the classical times and the medieval time was, as the scholars call this period of change, as the domestication of renounced order started taking place. So domestication of renounced order means the renounced order started becoming a part of society. They were no more aloof from society. They started coming closer to society. They still lived in monastic communities only, but then they acted as a spiritual teachers of society in general. Right? So they were not just gurus of the sannyasis or other brahmacharis in renounced order, but they would also start guiding and directing householders and people in general. Now, his role, these roles were being transformed because they wanted to set an example for the householders to live by the principles of devotional service, and they actively taught and spread their spiritual doctrines. Now, such examples were there in classical times also. If you see, you have Narad Muni, who is the guru of many kings, Prahlad, Dhruva, Prachinabari, and everybody. But the difference was, these personalities, they did not start their own disciplic successions. Dhruvasa Muni or Narad Muni did not start his own disciplic successions. But in the medieval time, when the sannyasis organized themselves into monastic communities, they started developing their disciplic successions, and we see that. So in this sequence came Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and Lord Chaitanya's acceptance of sannyas was also primarily so that he could preach well. He has social acceptance. In one sense, it was like it gave him a prestige by which he could preach in a certain way to a certain section of people. And he accepted sannyas in Advaita school and not in just Vaishnava school because of its social acceptance criteria. And his form of sannyas was a little softer as compared to classical and medieval times. And we'll see that, how the process of domestication became further developed. And Mahaprabhu's time onwards, he was interacting with society even more closely as compared to the classical and the medieval times. So if you look at the five tenets of classical renounced order, the classical sannyas is cutting social ties, mendicancy and food habits, abandoning ritualistic activities, celibacy, no fixed home. If you look at it vis-a-vis Mahaprabhu's life, so you see cutting social ties. So even though he accepted sannyas, but then on the request of his devotees, he settled down in Jagannath Puri, primarily on the desire of his own mother, which was quite unheard of from the classical sannyas perspective, because once you leave home, and his brother did that, right? His brother actually did that, and then Vishwarup just left and never turned back. But Mahaprabhu introduced a more softer version, because in all the activities of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the primary principle was the propagation, establishment of bhakti based on congregational chanting and mutual loving relationship between devotees. So he didn't want to displease the devotees. That was the primary consideration. So he said, okay, I'll accept sannyas, but then I'll stay wherever you want me to stay. So he stayed in Jagannath Puri. So in that sense, and then devotees were coming every 4 months, every year, all the Navdeep Vasis will be with Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So it was quite a social gathering that was happening. And as far as mendicancy and food habits, Lord Chaitanya would accept food at the house of Brahmanas and Vaishnavas. Scholars also say that there is hardly any mention of Mahaprabhu begging food anywhere. Because even when he went to South India, he had Kalakrishna Das with him who would beg food. And when he went to Vrindavan, there was Balbhadra Bhattacharya who would do all that stuff. So that was not such a strict, necessary need for Mahaprabhu to be following. His priorities were different. As far as abandoning ritualistic activities, like in the Advaita school, you cut your shikha. Brahmacharyas are supposed to have shikha, sannyasis don't have shikha, because cutting of shikha actually indicate you cut all social ties. Now you are not expected to perform any ritualistic activities. But Mahaprabhu did perform a lot of regulated spiritual activities, like celebrating Rath Yatra festival every year, or going to the temple twice in a day. These are all bhakti rituals which he did not give up. He continued following, even though, because he gave up, he rejected that concept which monists had, that once you accept sannyas, you become Narayan. So that concept was rejected. Therefore, certain rituals he continued. Even for that matter, Gundicha Marjan and things like that, that was never done by people from the classical order. As far as celibacy is concerned, there was no... This is one thing which is non-negotiable through all the development phases of the renounced order. He very strictly followed that, and we have several pastimes indicating how much importance Mahaprabhu laid on this one principle for people in the renounced order. And we have the example of he himself at one point of time when he is going towards the temple and near Yameshwar Tota, right? The garden where there is Yameshwar Mahadev, and then there is some Devidasi singing some stanza of the Gita Govind, and Mahaprabhu just swoons into ecstasy and is running, and then Govinda just stumbles behind him, catches him and just says, you know, this is a lady who is singing, and then Mahaprabhu becomes very sober. And the other very emphatic example is of Chota Haridas, where he very clearly, with a strong exclamation mark, indicated what is expected of people in the renounced order. So this is interesting, because Chota Haridas, whom he spoke to, is not mentioned in Chaitanya Charitamrita very explicitly. Madhavi Devi's name is mentioned, but that's a Vaishnavi, that's a Vriddha lady. She's an ascetic. So it was not clear in the Chaitanya Charitamrita about whether Mahaprabhu punished him for begging rice or for talking to somebody else. So some other commentators and acharyas also say that there was a young maidservant of Madhavi Devi whom he spoke to little intimately. Intimately could be just some simple interaction that happened. And then Mahaprabhu did not like that. And therefore Prabhupada, in several conversations and several, his lectures, he did mention about Chota Haridas talking to a young lady. So Mahaprabhu was very strict in that regard, and just to make that point very strong, he had to banish Chota Haridas from his association. And no fixed home, although that's a stricture, but Mahaprabhu just travelled for 6 years, from primarily when he was travelling to South India, and then some time for Vrindavan. Otherwise for 18 years he was staying in Jagannath Puri, in Gambhira, at one place. So we see that Mahaprabhu was kind of creating that transformation from the classical to the medieval, and from medieval to even a modern aspect of sannyas, where the priority is more devotional service to Lord Sri Krishna, pleasure to his devotees, association of devotees, and not just these classical concepts. Finally, after Mahaprabhu, as the documentation goes, as far as I remember, there was just some commentators, historians say that Gopal Bhatta Goswami accepted Tridanda Sannyas. But after that, there is nobody who is accepting the Saffron Order Tridanda Sannyas. They generally accept the Paramhamsa Babaji Vesh, till Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So when Srila Saraswati Thakur, he reintroduced the sannyas order by accepting himself sannyas on the day of Gaur Purnima in 1918, March 27. And he accepted sannyas in the mood of Shripad Ramanujacharya. So just like Shripad Ramanujacharya sat himself on the banks of Pushkarani in Vardaraj temple and accepted sannyas from the Lord directly. There's no sannyas guru of Shripad Ramanujacharya. He accepted from Vardaraj Swami. So similarly, Saraswati Thakur accepted sannyas from the picture of his guru meditating, and he gave him himself the name Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. Quite revolutionary, because there was no other way to restart the whole thing. And Saraswati Thakur's reasons for reintroducing sannyas were fourfold. He wanted to propagate Lord Chaitanya's teachings to all social strata. Second was to provide formal laws of spiritual leadership within the mission that he was about to establish, the Gaudiya Math, and uphold the sacred status of the Babaji dress. That was a very important thing, because the Paramhamsa stage, you know, Kutichak, Bahudak, Parivrajak and Paramhamsa, these are the four levels of the renounced order. So Paramhamsa was considered very high, but at that time many unscrupulous and unqualified people were misusing this particular stature for their own personal interests. So he stepped down and he said, we will not accept the Paramhamsa Vesh, which is meant for highly exalted people. We will go to the level of Parivrajakas, so that there is accountability and there is humility. So for these two reasons, he stepped down and reintroduced the concept of the saffron dress. So that you are close to society, society closely watches you, you are accountable for all your actions, as well as it's a humbling thing to step down from a higher level to a lower level for the purpose of preaching. And also to fourth reason he introduced sannyas was to provide practical living manifestations of the principle of Yukta Vairagya, which was a very important philosophical, you know, truths given by Srila Rupa Goswami. And in that sequence, Saraswati Thakur gave sannyas. If I am not wrong, it's around 20 sannyasis he gave in initiation. And then Prabhupada, 1959, he accepted the sannyas order. And after the establishment of ISKCON, this whole, you know, it actually became even more refined, in the sense a lot of changes happened. And sannyasis were now leading in many ways. They were not only spiritual leaders, they were also, you know, working closely with the society, leading a huge mission, dealing with finances and things like that. So roles changed, and paradoxically, the amount of prestige, the amount of social recognition that people in the renounced order started getting after Prabhupada established ISKCON was unimaginable. So that definitely opened doors of contribution to society in a certain way, but that also led to certain complications in terms of ISKCON history. So this is important to understand that. All these qualities which are being mentioned in these scriptures, what are they talking about? So they're talking about the classical sannyas, and then those principles have to be now laid down and, you know, applied in our current life. And the best way to do that is Mahajana Yena Gatasya Panta. So as Mahaprabhu did, as the Acharyas did, as the current sannyasis are doing, people in the renounced order, so we have to follow their footsteps. So like one of the complications that come while defining behavior in the for sannyasis in the modern context was, in the classical times there was this Manu Samhita which was guiding the behavior of people in the renounced order. And in the medieval times we had this Yati Dharma Samuchaya, who would actually define the roles and responsibilities of the sannyas order. But in the modern context we don't have a compendium which actually defines, and the historians say that the concept of Yukta Vairagya makes it even more blurred, because you just don't know how far you're supposed to go and pull yourself back. So hopefully in future something may come up. So this is some historical background about renounced order in relation to the verse. And out of all the various qualities which is mentioned in this verse, Ekachari Aniketa Apramatto Guhashaya Alakshamana Alpabhashana Munireko, so these qualities, one of the chief qualities, the most critical thing in all the above qualities is the apramattaha, alertness of the mind. Because one thing is, it is common to all stages of development of sannyas, and also even though all other items are present, but if one is not apramattaha, he may land into trouble. And therefore we see in the 5th canto Srimad Bhagavatam when Rishabhdev's teachings are going on, and then suddenly at the end, beginning of the 6th chapter, Parikshit Maharaj asks this question to Shukadeva Goswami, that Rishabhdev was a supreme personality of Godhead, and he had all mystic opulences, why didn't he utilize them? And suddenly Shukadeva Goswami for 3 verses changes his track, and he speaks very strongly about the nature of the mind, and then he comes back to his regular conversation. And he explains that how a transcendentalist, who is someone who is aspiring to be on a spiritual path, should never trust his mind. And he quotes the previous scholars, the previous devotees, the previous sages by saying, Tatha cha uktam. They have said like this. So it's not my conclusion. It is coming down from parampara. Na kuryat karhiti sakhyam manasi hi anavasthite. Yad vishrambha chirat chirnam chaskanda tapa aishwaram. That if you keep too much faith in the mind, the mind can cheat you. And he says Aishwaram. So in the translation, Prabhupada translates Aishwaram as example of Lord Shiva being bewildered by Mohini Murti or Saubhuri Muni falling from his yogic perfection. So he's saying if you make deep friendship with the mind and trust it too much, then it can cheat you. And he gives example of just like a husband is cheated by an unchaste woman's paramours. So if there's a lady who has extramarital affairs, then those paramours can come together and kill the husband. So in this similar manner, the mind with this lust, anger, greed, envy, pride, illusion, which are his associates, if you trust it too much, he will let them in, and that destroys the yogic perfection of somebody who is trying to make spiritual advancement. Bhagavatam gives several examples of this. I'll just quote two examples of somebody who had too much faith in the mind and or somehow just got tricked by the mind. One is Saubhuri Muni, a respectable sage who is performing austerities in Vrindavan under Yamuna. Can you imagine? Even geo signal will not reach there probably. Right? Underwater in the most holiest of all holy places in Yamuna, he is performing these austerities and he falls down. And after he falls down and he kind of gives up his, falls down in the sense he gives up his ascetic duties, his renunciation, and then goes out, marries the 50 daughters of King Mandhata. So one day he is contemplating. Aho imam pashyata me vinasham tapasvina satcharitavratasya antar jale vari chara prasangat prachayavitam brahmachiram dhritam yat. Are dekho mere saath kya hua. Aho imam pashyata me vinasham. Look at my situation. He is telling, like, you know, calling people, look at me, what has happened to me. Tapasvina satcharitavratasya. I used to follow such strict rules and regulations underwater, but I just saw Varichara prasangad. I just saw some Varichara. Varichara means aquatics. Interacting with each other. Right? I mean, you know, even the Mumbai teenage boy doesn't get agitated looking at an aquarium. There's some fishes. And he sees, Samacharya says, he sees a huge fish being followed by a lot of little fishes. That's all he saw. And it all about a desire, oh, maybe I should also have some association. Now, to this day, Saubhuri Muni doesn't know why did this happen to him. But by the grace of Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he had explained that it was because of his offense to Garuda. How he had once told Garuda, Garuda came for his breakfast, he saw there are some nice little fishes in this pond, but then all the fishes ran to Saubhuri Muni, please protect us from Garuda. And Saubhuri Muni said, okay, fine, I will protect you. And then he stopped Garuda and cursed him that if you ever come back here, you will die. And later on, Saubhuri Muni, he protected the fishes who became the cause of his fall down. The same fishes for whom he actually, what do you call it, took panga with Garudaji, they became the cause of his fall down. And he left with his austerities or whatever. Of course, Krishna always protects, so after he gets this realization, he goes to the forest, performs immense austerities and gets spiritual realizations. And you look at the fishes. As soon as Garuda was absent and Saubhuri fell away, Kalia came to live there. And all the fishes were also dead. So if you do Vaishnava Prad, all parties get destroyed. The party who takes action, the party who complains, the party who runs, whatever it is. If it's a Vaishnava Prada against a very powerful Vaishnava, nobody can be spared. And also an interesting lesson that how for a sadhaka, especially somebody in the renounced order, independent passion and independent compassion, both are dangerous. We cannot be beyond the umbrella of Sri Guru, the parampara. We are actually Like once in a conversation, Govind Prabhu was mentioning that how a person in the renounced order is the slave of the parampara. That means he imbibes their mood, he imbibes their desires and actually starts working toward them. But as soon as too much independence comes, you know, it creates problem. And then Swabari Muni is saying, his deep realization is saying, my recommendation is always stay in the association of devotees. Best, he first says, stay alone, or if required, stay in the association of people who are similarly minded. Stay in the association of people who are mukshubhi, who are aspiring for liberation. So in this way, we see Swabari Muni's example of, if there would have been at least two sadhus doing austerities together, so at least one of them could have told Swabari, "Are Garude bhaiya, don't take panga. Let him do whatever he wants to do. He's a great soul." But then that independence created havoc for him. The other example is Bharat Maharaj. Bharat Maharaj was on the level of Bhava, performing austerities on the banks of Gandaki River, completely absorbed. And Bhagavatam goes on describing verse after verse the ecstatic symptoms, the manifestations of Bharat Maharaj as he would worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But then one fine day, you know, this deer is drinking water and then there is a lion roaring. And some acharya says this lion was actually the roar of Narsingadev, just to create this trouble in the life of Bharat Maharaj to purify him further. But anyways, this deer came and then this lion roared, deer leaped. She had a miscarriage right inside the, in between the flight. Looks like a Hollywood scene, you know, flight. And then this child actually falls into the swiftly flowing river. And this deer falls on the other side in the cave and she's not visible. So immediately Bharat Maharaj gets up, goes into the river, picks up the deer. And it did not immediately bring him to the ashram. Bharat Maharaj actually picks up the deer and then goes to the other side of the river to hand it over to the mother deer. And then he goes there and he sees mother deer lying dead in a cave. And that makes him very soft and compassionate. He said, "Arre, arre, 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 arre. How can I leave this deer, baby deer now? So many lions, so many tiger, cheetahs are there, who will actually eat him?" Now this is a common occurrence. Deer always give birth to baby deers who grow up in a forest which is infested by lions and tigers. But then this whole idea which germinated in his heart that I have to give protection because of his soft heart and compassionate nature, gradually, shane shane, he actually became slack in his spiritual practices and had to take the body of a deer. Bhagavatam spends a lot of 7-8 chapters just describing this pastime to give us an understanding of how significant it is that independent passion, independent compassion, both can be disastrous. Especially in the Kali Yuga, you have to always just stay in the association of devotees. So for a neophyte, the situation of isolation is very dangerous and suicidal. So an environment where constructive feedback is given and is readily available is actually a sense of, is a conducive place for performing sadhana. Because we can be corrected, we can be directed in the proper direction. But for these feedbacks to have effects in our life, one needs very loving, trusting relationships. When we grow in spirituality, we become like effulgent mountains. And sometimes mountains can be closed but remain unconnected. So then there are bridges across the mountain which connect the two mountains with the valley in between. So that bridge is the bridge of relationships. And the wagons and the loads and the carriages that go over that bridge is the sense of concerned feedback that goes from one party to another party. So if there is no bridge, or if the bridge is weak, if the wagon is too heavy, then there is no question of we ever receiving a feedback and correcting our course of action. Therefore, a very crucial aspect in the life of a sadhaka is strong relationships in a Vaishnava community, which helps him move through this ordeal of performing sadhana bhakti with an uncontrolled mind which is always demanding attention. Without this strong relationship, on our own, ekaki amar nahi paye bal harinama sankirtan, it's not possible actually. Prabhupada said, if you think you can become Krishna conscious without association, you are insane. It's not possible. So on the mind being apramatta, mind being pramatta or being very restless, Srila Prabhupada writes a very beautiful purport. I'll read a section of it. This comes in the third canto, 26th chapter, text 23-24, where Prabhupada is speaking about the danger of how the mind can create problem. So Prabhupada is saying, not only must one come to the stage of pure Krishna consciousness, but one must also be very careful. Any inattentiveness or carelessness may cause fall down. This fall down is due to false ego. From the status of pure consciousness, the false ego is born because of misuse of independence. And Prabhupada gives a classic statement. He says, we cannot argue about why a false ego arises from pure consciousness. There is no reason. You cannot figure it out. How did this happen? Factually, there is always the chance that this will happen, and therefore one has to be very careful. False ego is the basic principle for all material activities which are executed in the modes of material nature. As soon as one deviates from pure Krishna consciousness, he increases his entanglement in material reaction. And this entanglement of materialism is the material mind from which material existence then unfolds. So one has to learn to discriminate between the self and the mind. Chaitanya Charan Prabhu, in his one of his seminars, he very graphically describes how the mind goes through the eight stages of fall down, right? Dhyayato vishyan pumsam sangaste shubhajayate sangha sanjayate kamat kamat krodho vijayate. There are eight stages. And he said how the mind functions in the first two stages, the mind speaks in the second person. He is in a suggestive mode. If you do this, you'll be happy. If you do this, you'll be relaxed. If you do this, you will enjoy. But from the third stage, he starts speaking in the first person. It starts demanding things. And he says, once you enter the third stage, then it is very difficult to reverse the desires of the mind. You have to take action in the first two only. Which means you have to basically, you know, distinguish between the voice of the self and voice of the mind, which is very difficult. Is it the mind who is asking, or is it actually me, the spirit soul, who is actually needing certain kind of needs? So just memorizing technical details of Shastra or mechanically repeating certain rituals, that's not going to help. It's a very serious kind of, it's very insidious, as they say. And if you know, I was once reading Suhotra Maharaj's book, Vedanta Psychology, and it was, he kind of, like a detective, unfolds the insidious nature of the mind, of how mind is not going to let go of these desires so easily. And he says, the proof is, we have been trying so many times, we have attempted so many times to give up certain desires, and they keep coming back. So certain deeper things has to do it. So the solution that Acharyas give, and Maharaj mentions in his book, he says, the only way you can actually start distinguish between the self and the mind is through the process of chanting the holy names of Krishna. Without chanting, there is no way to know how to discriminate between the two. Our endeavors to control the mind begins and end with chanting Hare Krishna. So when we chant the holy names, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare, we are basically expressing our helplessness towards the Lord. And once I remember Govind Prabhu was mentioning in one of our Brahmachari classes, he said the morning hours of sadhana bhakti is the time a sadhaka experiences and practices helplessness. Because we become very expert in many things. Managing, accounting, cooking, preaching, speaking, painting, deity worship. By just doing them repeatedly, it just becomes your second nature. It's very easy. He was explaining. But he said, once you sit with the holy name and you realize that my mind is still wandering the same way as it used to do 2 decades back, it makes you humble and makes you helpless. And he says, that is the process of bhakti. When you helplessly turn towards Krishna, then he takes it upon himself to control the mind. On our own, it's not a difficult thing, it's an impossible thing to deal with the mind which is contaminated by the modes. So, Kapil Dev, when Mother Devuti asked him this question, that this material mind and the senses, sense objects are very closely intertwined. How do you separate them? Because there is no existence of the mind without sense objects, and there is no question of sense objects existence without the mind. And the example is given just like somebody is cooking puris in ghee, and you get a nice fragrance, and the mind gets excited, oh, there is nice prasad there. So that niceness is not in the ghee or in the puri. It's in the experience that the mind has stored. So the sense object has relevance only as long as the mind exists. And the mind's existence is only as long as sense objects exist. If there are no desires in the mind, then there is no question of the mind. Mind is a store also of desires. So they are very closely intertwined. You cannot separate one from the other. Like salt kneaded into dough. Once it is kneaded into dough, you can't separate it by any process. So Lord Kapila, he very mercifully gives this process. He says, Tivraya mai bhaktaya cha shuta sambrataya chiram. That one has to hear about Krishna, perform very intense devotional service for a very long period of time. Now, intense devotional service, 1-2 days, okay. Long period of time. This long is not defined now. One life, two life, how many life, kalpas of Brahma, depends on your intensity and Krishna's desire. So, to graduate from this long-standing attachment to matter, basically between the attachment we have but we don't want, that is rajas, and the attachment we want but we don't have, which is rasa. So in order to move from this rajas to rasa, it's a very long journey. So how do you maintain your balance while you are navigating through this journey? So Maharaj explains that how the middle ground between these two destinations is vyavar, relationship amongst devotees. That gives us a solid foundation for making this journey possible from rajas to rasa. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu mentions this, dharma sthapana hetu sadhura vyavar. A devotee's behavior establishes the true purpose of religious principles. In other words, sadhur vyavar, the behavior of devotees within the material world, is the middle ground where dharma sthapana hetu, or the difference between right and wrong, is made clear. So the ability to discriminate comes when we are protected in a very sweet, loving relationship of devotees, and we are in the mood of actually seeking shelter and feeling sheltered in that association. Then Paramatma reveals this capacity to distinguish between what is right, what is wrong, what is favorable, what is unfavorable, and also gives us the strength to practice it. So conclusion, you know, he kind of says is that we have to start relating with devotees in a very, you know, in a sanguine manner, so that we develop very strong, healthy relationships. I remember once in a conversation, Gaur Gopal Prabhu was mentioning that how there will be a lot of challenges while you are living in the ashram life as a monastic order, but you should always have someone senior whom you are always accountable to. And he was explaining his own example, and he was saying that how, although so many years have been spent in the ashram, but he voluntarily, you know, accepts Govind Prabhu as a senior and confides him and shares his heart with him. He said, you should always have someone senior where you can always relate your heart, express your challenges, express your problems. Never be alone with nobody on the top in the mood that I can make it on my own. It's a very risky kind of situation, especially somebody who is trying to move in the path of renunciation. So this is strong relationships is where Shastra is saying you gain the strength to tolerate the mind. Prasangam, acharam, pasham, atmano, kavayo vidu. What is that next word? Sa eva sadhu shukrito moksha dwaram bhavratam. That this attachment to sense object is very difficult to give up, but learned transcendentalists have said that if you somehow get attached to the sadhus, moksha dwaram bhavratam, the door of liberation is open by attachment to a sadhu. So this is very critical. Unless we experience this emotional attachment with devotees, we will not be able to give up our connection with this material world. We maintain it secretly. because that's where rasa is still coming from. Rasa from Krishna is difficult to get, and we don't have a strong relationship, healthy relationship based on hearing and chanting, based on trust, based on nice reciprocation. Then we don't experience that rasa. Then the mind starts running towards the older rasa that it has experienced. And Shastra says that when envy creeps into relationship of devotees, then the purification of lusty desires that happens because of sadhu sangha becomes severely hampered. And therefore we see when the offenses start taking place amongst devotees, then the old desires may start stemming up again. And if we are not in a situation where we can share our hearts, it becomes extremely difficult to manage that struggle. So we have to acknowledge that we are struggling, understand the importance of staying in the association of devotees. Because what happens, human beings, this species by nature is in mode of passion. It is rajasic. So if when we engage in devotional activities also, spiritual activities also, if we are not having an uplifting force because of association, we can even become frustrated in our spiritual activities. We can become exhausted even with our spiritual activities. Through the principles of chanting the holy names, associating with devotees, serving, even that can become exhausting because of this rajoguna being present. And then rajoguna degrades to tamoguna, where moroseness, laziness, frustration, depression, all these kind of things also start gravitating. So one has to, then what happens is, when somebody is performing devotional service in this rajasic mood of just getting things done. Like once I was doing D&D, it's a very nice service, and one of my senior god brothers, he was preparing his tray, and he said, so do you believe in doing fast or going fast? I said, what exactly does that mean? He said, are you the one who works fast, or are you in the mood always thinking, kab khatam hoga, kab khatam hoga, kab khatam hoga? And it struck me so hard. I said, wow. Even while those 2 hours, the mind is simply anticipating the end. When will this seva get over? And not relish the time when the service is being performed. And when I look upon he as a personal example, when he is serving the deity, worshipping the deities, he is there for them. He's not looking at the watch, I have to run here, run there. No, I'm talking about Hare Krishna Prabhu. So, he's always there, present, and just worshipping them with all his heart. So he told me, and I said, Prabhuji, fortunately, doing fast, I'm not sure, but I'm definitely not going fast wala category. I'll stay there as long as you want me to. But this happens. We're in so much rajogun. As soon as devotional service begins, we are thinking of agla kya, agla kya, agla kya. And the whole aspect where we are supposed to absorb the mind is still somewhere else. And the senses are just engaged in some actions. And therefore Bhaktivedyapurna Maharaj in one lecture, he was saying that how that's why sometimes a decade later suddenly somebody disappears. Why? Because he never engaged his mind in devotional activities. And we have heard from many of the experienced sadhus here that how the mind functions in decades. 10 saal ke baad prashn poochta hai wo. What are you doing here? The newness experience is over. Now what? Right? So if you have not practiced putting the mind into devotional activities, then it becomes very difficult. So then either he falls into the voidistic principles, or he starts falling into the aspect of his sensual behavior of the past. This is what happens when somebody becomes tired and exhausted of devotional service because of rajasic mentality, then he starts going to either of the ways. And then many times we hear this parlance, that how what can repression accomplish? I am who I am. And once Govind Prabhu actually explained this understanding very well, he said when Krishna is saying what can repression accomplish, he is not talking about the lower base animalistic tendencies. That has to be given up. But then he is talking about the natural inclination of a jiva to serve Krishna in a certain way. So, I have to conclude, his time is up. So basically, we have to come to the platform of actual devotional service where the mind is being engaged and gradually experiencing rasa, and this whole thing becomes easy when we have loving association of devotees. Without that, it's not possible. It has not happened, and as the acharyas have said, it will also not happen. That has to happen only in the association of the loving devotees, and we have to make an attempt to actually make that happen. And in that loving association of devotees, when we take shelter of the process of chanting the holy names of the Lord, then the heart becomes purified. And I'll conclude with this one verse from Kali Santaran Upanishad. I found it very inspiring. He says that how there are 16 layers on the soul. The 5 Jnanendriyas, 5 Karmendriyas, 5 sense objects, and the false ego. And he said this 16 word Hare Krishna Mahamantra is the only weapon which can penetrate these 16 layers. It says, Iti Shodasha Kalasya Jivasya Avarana Vinasham. The covering of the Jiva is destroyed with this Shodasha Nam. Tatha Prakashate Parabrahma Megapai Ravi Rasmi Mandali Veti. And then the Lord, Sri Hari, who is situated in the heart of the Jiva, with the Jiva, he becomes resplendently visible, just like the sun in the firmament becomes visible when the dark clouds are removed. Similarly, the holy name of Krishna is the only tool that we have by which we can actually penetrate these 16 layers and one day have the darshan of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And that's our hope, that's the purpose that Srila Prabhupada established the society. And that's the main gift Srila Prabhupada has given us, the opportunity to hear and chant the holy names of Sri Krishna, Krishna's name, Krishna's fame in the association of devotees. And when we chant the Lord's holy names, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare, with the background of loving association and relationship based on seva, then that process purifies our heart. As His Holiness Radhana Swami Maharaj said, your sadhana, your chanting of the holy names will have the purifying effect in proportion. It will affect your consciousness to the degree your relationships are sweet and nice. I'm paraphrasing. But our sadhana is going to purify our consciousness to the extent we have deep, loving, sweet relationship amongst devotees, where Krishna is pleased to bestow His kind grace. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Granth Rashmat Bhagavat Mahapurana ki jai.